From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. On this edition, Elizabeth Lesser, co-founder of Omega Institute, joins us to talk about her latest book, Broken Open: How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Elizabeth Lesser is the co-founder of Omega Institute, the United States' largest lifelong learning center focusing on health, wellness, spirituality, creativity, and social change. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Broken Open: How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow, and The Seeker's Guide: Making Your Life a Spiritual Adventure. For more than 30 years, Elizabeth has worked with leading figures in the fields of healing, healing self, and healing society. Her work at Omega has included leading the organization, developing its curricula, teaching, and writing the yearly Omega Catalog, a reference book that describes the work of some of the most eminent thinkers and practitioners of our times. For the past 10 years, Elizabeth has spearheaded Omega's popular Women in Power conferences, renowned gatherings featuring women leaders, authors, activists, and artists from around the world. She's the founder of the Women's Leadership Center at Omega, and in 2008, she helped Oprah Winfrey produce a 10-week online seminar based on Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth. The webinar was viewed by more than 2 million people worldwide. Since then, she has appeared several times on the Oprah Winfrey television show and Oprah.com webcasts, and is an ongoing host on Oprah's Soul Series, a weekly radio show on Sirius XM. Ms. Lesser is also a frequent presenter at conferences nationwide, including the 2010 TED Women's Conference. Her first book, The Seeker's Guide, chronicles the uprising of a new global spirituality that she participated in and researched through her work at Omega. Her second book, Broken Open, is a guide for anyone going through a difficult time. Its real-life stories inspire the reader to use adversity for inner growth. Broken Open has been translated into 16 languages. Founded in 1977, Omega Institute for Holistic Studies is the nation's most trusted source for wellness and personal growth. As a nonprofit organization, Omega offers diverse and innovative educational experiences that inspire an integrated approach to personal and social change. Located on 195 acres in the beautiful Hudson Valley, Omega welcomes more than 23,000 people to its workshops, conferences, and retreats in Rhinebeck, New York, and at exceptional locations around the world. Elizabeth Lesser attended Bernard College and San Francisco State University. Previous to her work at Omega, she was a midwife and birth educator. She's been active in environmental issues for many years in New York State's Hudson Valley and Catskill Mountains, where she lives with her husband. She's a mother of 3 grown sons, and it's from the Catskills that she joins us today. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have not only enjoyed the books you have written, but I have been a big fan and follower of Omega over the years, so it's a real honor that you're with us today. Before I ask you the first question, I want to share the quote that goes with it from your book, Broken Open. And the quote goes, "The time came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom." The quote was on a painting you encountered while on a trip to Jerusalem. The experience you had when you were shown this painting, I think, sets the stage for the book and all the stories you share. I love this, as it really got my attention from the moment I began to read your book. Can you recount the story about the painting for our listeners?
Sure. First of all, that quote, even though I first read it in a dusty rug store in Jerusalem, is from the author Anais Nin, who wrote in the early 20th century, "And the time came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom." Mm. So I first saw that when I was in a particularly difficult time of my life. I was a young mother. I was in a marriage that was very unhappy and falling apart, and I had gone on a trip with a friend to Jerusalem just because I was such a mess. I didn't know quite what else to do, and she was leading one of those tours to the holy city of Jerusalem for people who were interested in the spiritual dimension of the city, and I went along, and they would go off on trips, and I was so unhappy and struggling with, should I stay married, should I not, what about my little kids, what should I do, that I would just stay home and be by myself in the hotel because I just didn't want to socialize. I'm sure all of you listening have been at times in your life like that. So on this particular day, I headed into the old city by myself and was just wandering around and came to one of these little shops that catered to the Western traveler. So it was a rug store and a tea shop, and it had all sorts of things for sale and paintings and artifacts. And it was run by two Arab men. And I went in there, and I was just standing there looking at things, and one of the men, the younger man, took me back and said, I think in his broken English, I think you would like this painting. It was a painting of a rose with that quote on it. And the quote just seared into my heart, This idea that I was tight in a bud, and I was so terrified of opening up, and it was so painful to stay really tightly wound around myself, but the risk of blossoming into my full self was equally scary. I was at that impasse, and it was really that meeting in that very unlikely place so far away from home and seeing that I began the process of what I call, and what I titled my book, Broken Open, this process of letting yourself open, even if it means things are going to break all around you so that you can step into your blossom, your fullness.
In your introduction, you talk about how to be human is to be lost in the woods. You talk about the powerful occurrences and transformations that can take place when people are broken open. You write, in their most broken moments, they were brought to their knees, they were humbled, they were opened, and later, as they pulled the pieces back together, they discovered a clearer sense of purpose and a new passion for life. Yet, you also talk about people who go to sleep during those challenging times as a way to cope with the intensity. Concerning those people, you write, but we also know people who did not turn their misfortune into insight or their grief into joy. Instead, they became more bitter, more reactive, more cynical. They shut down. They went back to sleep. And then you quote the great poet Rumi. It's hard to stay awake, isn't it, when you're going through difficult times? I've known many, many people. I probably have done that before in my past, where I chose to just go asleep during a tough time.
Yeah. Well, I think we all can relate to that. Life is a series of choices all the time, little and big ones, to are you going to step up to the plate and really look at yourself and your responsibility in this moment, and are you going to pray for the light of truth to show you what's really going on, and if being in truth requires you to have a conflictual conversation with someone or look at something in your life that isn't working and you might have to make some big changes and sacrifices, oh my God, it can be so overwhelming, and so I'm just too tired, I don't want to do it. And of course, none of us can live the kind of life where we're constantly self-examining and constantly making changes. I mean, We all have to, like, have a job and make a living and fix the car and put up with the idiosyncrasies of our mates and our children. So I'm not advocating, like, some sort of Don Quixote behavior at every minute. But there are those moments in life where going back to sleep, you're going to pay the price. And in a lifetime over and over of not dealing, this is what begins to add up to stress, disease, and misery, and bitterness. And when you meet people later on in life who are like people in their 70s and 80s and beyond, who are still vibrant and alive, and you were to ask them to tell you about their life, I can assure you those who stay lively throughout a lifetime are brave. They're brave spiritual warriors. And by that I mean, when it counts, they choose to break open as opposed to go underground and shrivel up.
And let's visit that Rumi poem that you used because I think it's so powerful. Rumi wrote, "The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. People are going back and forth across the doors. Where the two worlds touch, the door is round and open. Don't go back to sleep." I love that line, "The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you." And also, "You must ask for what you really want." I find, Elizabeth, that in so many areas of our life, that's a key issue. People are often afraid to ask for what they want.
Yeah, because it's a lot easier to kvetch about not getting what you want, and blaming and they and those people and I don't get, to complain. It's a lot easier to do that than to risk actually standing up and believing in your own needs and desires enough to ask for it. I don't mean to demand it, to run people over in your egomaniacal search for what I want, but to actually, Rumi used the word, "You must ask for what you want." He didn't say you must go out and take everything you want. He said, be in the kind of relationship with other people in your life where you are brave enough to say, you know, this isn't working for me. I need X, Y, or Z. And then putting yourself in at risk of, you know, let's say telling your boss at work, I need more money to do what I'm doing. I deserve it. Other people who are working at the same level I am are getting it. I need it. So you're putting yourself at risk there. Maybe your boss will say, no, absolutely not. I don't agree with you. You're not as valuable. No. So then you're risking looking at yourself. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I do need to step up more and prove myself more. Or maybe you're risking saying, okay, then I'm going to leave. Or maybe you're risking the boss firing you for being so audacious. But if you don't take that risk of asking for what you want, you live a half life and you begin to actually shrink a little bit.
Elizabeth, very early on in your book, I believe it's at the end of the first chapter, you say, if we don't listen to the voice of the soul, it sings a stranger tune. If we don't go looking for what lies beneath the surface of our lives, the soul comes looking for us. That is so true. I find that if you don't answer when that voice of the soul knocks, it just pounds harder and harder until you do. Can you talk about that voice of the soul and what that means to you and to us as beings?
You say the word soul, and I think we often think of all the lovely, warm and fuzzy things that the soul is. But the soul is also those sleeping giants in us, the shadow, what Jung called the shadow. Every lightness has its shadow. And we, especially those of us who call ourselves spiritual seekers, we often don't want to look at the dark parts of our life, but there's so much richness in the parts of our life that aren't working, that have things to tell us. The story I tell of my own life in Broken Open, I mean, in the book I tell the story of a lot of different people's struggles in life, but the thread through the book is my divorce, which was years ago for me now, but it was that one first big experience where I decided to listen to my soul. And my unhappiness was my soul's way of telling me something is going on that you might want to pay attention to. And the thing about when you turn around and listen to the soul is you think maybe it will give you exact information of what to do and it'll be easy and you'll follow it and you'll suddenly be on the other side. But to follow the soul can be dangerous, and it also can end up not being about what you thought it was. Yes, in my particular storyline here, it was about a marriage that had to fall apart. But more than anything, it was about my own responsibility within the marriage for what didn't work. I had to look at myself. I had to look at all of the things I was blaming other people for, situations for, and see what I had created and what I needed to do in order to make a better life for myself and my children.
Mm.
And that's what the voice of the soul. The soul says, there's no room for blame in this world. This is all about you taking the reins of your life and making it into something glorious. That's often why people don't want to listen to the true soul, because it's a lot easier often to just kind of blame it on them or him or her, as opposed to looking deep at your own shadow stuff.
When you talk about your visit to the psychic, I think it's in chapter 2 or 3, it's early in the book, you have this amazing experience, Elizabeth, where she asks you a question that gives a fresh perspective on aspects of your life that you've been pondering for some time. I can only imagine the surprise you must have felt when she asked for the letter you unknowingly had in your purse. She asks you, what lesson does your soul want to learn? Do you know? I mean, what a great question. It really makes one think. And then she tells you that what's important in life is to learn the soul lessons. What a great experience you had with her, and at just the right time for your life. This clearly had to be a pivotal moment for you in starting the next chapter of your life.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember when I decided to start the book with that story early on in the book, and my mother, who was a English teacher and an intellectual, and she said, don't put a story about a psychic in your book. Like, that's immediately going to, like, bring your clout down, because, you know, a lot of people don't believe in psychics.
Uh-huh.
And for me, you know, a friend of mine who saw how I was struggling so much and said, go to a psychic. And this is an amazing woman, and she's seen deep into my own life patterns and see what she says. So I went with a lot of skepticism because, of course, like everyone, my mother is alive and well in my psyche. And I was flabbergasted by what she knew without knowing me. That was a fabulous part of the experience, but as you say, the best part was that question she asked me. She said, you may think you're going through this hard time, in my case, a marriage that was falling apart, like to get out of the marriage and find a new love and have romance guide your life again, but no, you're in this hard time to learn what your soul really needs in order to thrive in this life. That was a turning point for me to, instead of thinking that I was in this situation in order to get out of a marriage and start all over, I really took it deeply, like, this, I am not going to squander such a traumatic event for myself, for my children, for my ex-husband, by not learning the deep soul lessons of how to live, how to be a better person.
Now, that is huge, because if we don't do that, we can often repeat those lessons.
Not often, always.
Always, yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing. I would be lying to say, and then I never repeated those soul lessons. You know? But how I have progressed, I believe, is that I'm much more able now, when things get difficult or when I feel myself slipping into old patterns, to see it, to know it. There I go again. There I go, projecting onto someone else as opposed to looking at myself and taking responsibility. There I go, blaming. There I go, not being loving and open. Once you start the process of asking the soul, what is this situation here to teach me? I mean, really teach me about me. Once you start it, there's no going back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My guest today is Elizabeth Lesser, not only co-founder of Omega Institute, a best-selling author. We're talking about her latest book. It's called Broken Open, How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow, something that I think we all need to learn more about. You have a chapter, Elizabeth, called Open Secret, and you talk about how we as humans tend to isolate ourselves. You write, one of the greatest enigmas of human behavior is the way we isolate ourselves from each other. and our misguided perception of separation. We assume that others are not sharing a similar experience of life. We imagine that we are unique in our eccentricities or failures or longings, and so we try to appear as happy and consistent as we think others are. And we feel shame when we stumble and fall. When difficulties come our way, we don't readily seek out help and compassion because we think others might not understand or would judge us harshly or take advantage of our weakness. And so we hide out and we miss out. We hide out and we miss out. That is so true. It seems like oftentimes we're so worried that we miss the gift of connection. Can you talk about Rumi and his open secret?
Yeah, Rumi, who is the great Persian mystic, Sufi poet. You know, he's the most popular poet in the world, even though he wrote in the 12th century and lived in Persia. His little concepts like the open secret are so universal and timeless. By the open secret, he means that we all go around thinking we're hiding a secret from each other, not some like big racy secret. It's a very simple secret. It's, I hurt. I'm confused. I don't know what to do. Am I doing the right thing? Should I have this job? Is my marriage okay? Oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm so messed up. We hide that from each other because we think I'm the only one. I mean, look how great her life works. Look at him. He looks fantastic. And we all, the openness, the joke about it, actually, is that everyone is safeguarding that same secret. We're all confused. I call it we're all bozos on the bus. But we try so hard to pretend we aren't. Now, there's a tragedy in that. It's not like the world's worst thing to be doing that, but there's a tragedy in it because the way to find real connection and solace and friendship is by opening up your open secret to each other. So when someone says to you, how are you? Instead of saying, fine, everything's great, oh, the kids are great, my job is wonderful, unless that's true, and sometimes it is, but a good deal of the time, it's like, I'm okay, my kid is kind of failing second grade, and I'm so harried at work, I just don't know how to do this work-life balance, or whatever it is going on in your life. It's amazing when you actually get honest with another person, even if you don't know that person that well, it presents an opening for that person to go, oh, I'm safe here. I'm safe just to be another bozo on the bus with this person.
Yes, I love that phrase, bozos on the bus.
Mm-hmm. And then you get, not only do you get a warm intimacy with another human being, something we all long for, but you suddenly feel like, whoa, I'm not such a freak.
Yeah.
I'm just a regular person. It's so empowering, emboldening. It gives you solace. It gives you a sense of humor. You stop taking it all so seriously. And it's the most simple secret there is to joyful connection with others.
You know, I found, Elizabeth, in the work that I've done through the radio show and some of the speakers that I brought to Indianapolis, all great people, all best-selling authors and such, but the ones I've really connected with would be people who I guess I would call bozos on the bus.
Yeah.
They seem transparent and real and authentic.
You know, I have, like you, met hundreds, maybe thousands of psychological thinkers and spiritual teachers and healers and health experts through my 36 years at Omega Institute. You know, I helped start it when I was just in my 20s. And so over all these years, I've met so many people. I've met some of the most brilliant minds and open hearts. And I agree with you. The people who touch me the most, help me the most, inspire me the most, are the real, genuine people.
Yeah. Not to put you on the spot, but I think I read somewhere where you highlighted one of the people, because you've had everybody there at Omega. And it was somebody who I have long respected, and I must say I've never had the privilege yet of meeting him, but I've read every one of his books, and that's Stephen Levine. There was something about his presence.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I haven't seen him in many years. He was one of our very first teachers at Omega, and he was one of the first people in this country to do work with people who were dying.
Yeah.
And he would have retreats on our campus with 300-400 people who were in various forms of dying. Some within days after the retreat, we would hear died. So when you're in the presence of hundreds of people who are looking at perhaps the last months or year of their life, I'm telling you, the pretense just goes away. And you are with a bunch of bozos, because our mortality makes us all very vulnerable.
It really does. I've learned that in some of the hospice work that I've done.
Yeah.
And there is a fearlessness that some people finally break through when they're facing their own mortality. And speaking of that word fearlessness, I want to go to a chapter that's entitled Heart Warrior. You talk about your experience with the teachings of Tibetan Buddhist Chogyam Trungpa. You talk about his teachings that led you into the face of fear, and you say he was not interested in spirituality as a form of escape. And you use a quote from him that I absolutely love, and a quote is, "There is no dry land. There is only fearlessness, which is to be found in the heart. This is the path to freedom." This is such a beautiful quote, yet a hard one, I think, to embrace easily. You, in this chapter, talk about not following it until many years later. So, Elizabeth, can you share about the shift that caused you to begin to walk that path that he talked about?
Well, I think most of us come to spirituality looking for the dry land, to continue in the vein of his quote. It's so scary being a human being. I mean, goodness, you know, we are born without an instruction book. There's so much to navigate. What is my purpose? What should I do? Who should I be with? Where should I live? And then the minute you think you've got it all figured out, traumas happen in your health, in your relationships, in your work. It's never ending, this. If our quest in life is for security and dry land, we're always being disappointed, because there is no dry land, as he said, if by dry land we mean we've finally gotten to the plateau of safety and happiness forever. It just doesn't work that way. But what does work is finding a fearless spirit and heart so that you can surf the waves and not always be looking for that landing place where everything's going to be okay. There's just something so liberating about getting it into our thick heads that, no, the purpose of this human life is not to find dry land. Now, many people will take on a religion that promises dry land and find solace in and hang onto it for dear life. That's not the path I've walked. I have loved all of the great prophets and holy books, but none have ever been a crutch for me. They've more been oars as I kind of keep rowing my way over the choppy sea.
And like you, I have surfed a lot of waves in my lifetime. I love that phrase. In one of your chapters, I think it was the chapter entitled Lightening Up and Falling Down. I just love that as a mantra, actually, the title of that. You talk about hopping over the edge into the unknown with eyes wide open. You write in your book, "I pray that each of us stays awake as we fall. I pray that we choose to go into the abyss willingly, and that our fall is cushioned by faith. Faith that at the bottom we will be caught and taught and turned toward the light." I think stepping into that abyss, Elizabeth, is one of the most challenging things that we as humans can do, a step that many are unwilling to take. I just happened to read a quote last night on Facebook, actually, about the abyss and trusting that there is a feather bed at the bottom. Do you have any suggestions for how to increase our trust in the existence of that feather bed or faith?
Well, one way that's worked for me is to do a review of my life to date and think of the things that terrified me and kept me fighting all the way to the edge of the abyss, and then to really look and see what happened. Was it really as awful as I thought it was going to be? Did I pull myself up afterwards? Did I learn anything? Did things actually get better or at least different in a way that was worthy and worthwhile? And most people will say, oh, yeah, yeah, it wasn't so terrible when I got fired. My house did burn down, but then I ended up moving to this wonderful new place, or I met this person. You can usually, if you do a tracing, an arc of what has happened in your life, you can train yourself to have more faith that on the other side of catastrophe is usually everything from something way better to at least a lesson that you take with you to cushion the fall. And I believe that that can be true for everything, even a diagnosis of a terminal disease, even bankruptcy, even some of the very worst things you think that can happen to you, if you vow to use whatever comes your way for growth and moving on. I mean, I often look at some of the bigger things that happen, like 9/11 in this country, or like what happened in Newtown, Connecticut. And these were enormous traumas and sacrifice, and also opportunities, like had we turned around and looked at America's shadow after 9/11, and had we been led as a country to do a little soul searching and saying, no, this wasn't our fault, we didn't ask for this, but was there anything we could learn as a country that perhaps could make us a better global neighbor to other people? Can we change? Can we teach the whole world something about how to deal with trauma through love as opposed to retribution? Had we done that, I think it would be a different world and America and economy and many other things today. So that was a lost opportunity.
Yeah.
And what's going on now with the whole gun question? It's complicated. It's not going to be an easy answer, but if we can as a country use it to search for something other than just us going into our corners of liberals and conservatives and being pissed off at each other, wouldn't that be great? And it's the same in our own life when catastrophe strikes, which it does to all of us in one way or another, to turn around and ask, you know, what can I learn from this?
And what you're talking about, you write about so well in a chapter on September 11th. It's when you began to see, and you had a prayer somewhere in that book about putting aside your aversions towards those with different opinions and such. But what struck me in that was towards the end of that chapter when a waitress came over to your table. And I have it in front of me. I was thumbing it while I was, and the waitress was quietly listening. She was crying, too. She put her arm around me, meaning you, and she said, I work during the week at the Windows on the World, referring to the restaurant on the top of the World Trade Center. I lost 50 friends on Tuesday. They were serving breakfast, and a silence fell over the table like the rain on a dry field. And the only thing you should be talking about tonight is how precious your life is, how lucky you are to be alive, how important it is to love each other. And she stood with her arm around me. How lucky you are. There's that shift you're talking about that we all need to be making now more than ever.
Right. Yeah. It is one of the great mysteries to me about how trauma and loss can actually open your heart and tenderize it so much. You know how after 9/11, since I'm a New Yorker, I mean the vibe in the city was one of so much love and love toward each other, love toward strangers. There was so much helping each other. If you ask me, that's reality. That is where we could all be at all times. It's sad that it takes an emergency for us to open our hearts and that we close back up so easily. But my spiritual path and my prayer for humanity is that we remain tender as much as we can toward each other, toward our children, toward our husbands and wives, toward our town mates, toward everyone in the world. That's the proof. People often say, well, what? How do you know if someone's spiritual? What does it mean? To me, it means that you can stay open and tender and loving toward yourself and toward others.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's huge, isn't it? It's this broken heart is an open heart, which I believe is the title of one of your chapters in the book. It reminded me of a conversation I had when I first met Andrew Harvey, and he was beginning to teach on sacred activism. We brought him here to Indianapolis, and Andrew and I were over a glass of wine. I asked him this question. I said, Andrew, you travel all around the world. You're teaching hardcore spiritual groups that are just oming themselves to death. You're talking to angry activists. Which group do you find is more open to this sacred activism that you're talking about? And he got real quiet. He looked at me, and I'll always remember his voice, and he said, those who are broken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this book is about.
Yeah. Yeah. And broken open. You can get broken and unrepairably broken, but usually that is not because something happened to you. It's because of what you did when it happened to you. So, you know, the people who I bow to probably with the most compassion are those who lose children.
Oh, yes.
And the nobility of people who take that loss and spin it into having a life of purpose and a life of giving to others. There's just something saintly about people who take enormous loss and spin it into an open heart.
We were talking about broken heart, open heart. And speaking of the heart, you got to watch open heart surgery.
I did.
I can't imagine experiencing that. You tell about this experience in your book, and I'm wondering, what was that like? I bet that really put things in an entirely different perspective to see the heart exposed and even removed from the body during the procedure.
Yeah, well, my first job in life, what I trained for, I was a midwife. Uh-huh. I helped babies being born. I delivered babies. And so I have a great tolerance for gore and guts. Like, my husband won't even watch operations on television dramas, you know, like Grey's Anatomy, he won't even watch. But, like, I'm sort of like a moth to the flame with anything that has to do with the human body. I happen to like it. So it wasn't a huge stretch for me, but it was amazing. I had been writing about and talking about hearts, the metaphoric heart, for so long. I thought, I'd really like to see a real human heart. So someone who had taken a workshop with me at Omega Institute was a heart surgeon, and he invited me to come and watch him. And it was really phenomenal to get into the heart in order to operate on it. They had to saw open the chest bones, the ribs, with an actual, like, power saw, and then pull it back with this metal claws. And it was so metaphoric to me of what it can feel like when you're going through a difficult time, how hard it is to keep your heart open. So often, what you want to do, you know, I'm going through this right now with my younger sister who has a recurrence of a very serious cancer, and very well maybe a terminal illness. There's not much right now that can be done. And I watch this battle in her to keep her heart open, not to get bitter, not to get angry, not to get terrified, but to stay soft and open, because she knows that if she does, that her real hope at surviving is staying open, because then she can be curious and research her disease and work with the doctors and work with other healing methodologies. The minute you shut down, you lose that elasticity of brain and will. And so seeing that that what it took to open the heart was such a metaphor for me about how difficult it is for all of us to stay open and soft and not to become clamped shut. So that's what I took away from that open heart surgery.
Mm. You are the co-founder of one of the most significant spiritual retreat centers in the world. In your previous book, Elizabeth, the book called The Seeker's Guide, you give a little quote at the beginning that provides a day-in-the-life snapshot of your life at Omega. You write, "Over the years, I've shared countless meals with conferences and workshop leaders in that room, moderating discussions between medical doctors and shamanic healers, Christian monks and Jewish rabbis, Zen teachers and business executives. While at lunch one day, seated next to Baba Olatunji, you asked, 'So what do you make of this, all these traditions meeting and merging?' His answer was, 'This is a new kind of spirituality. It's American, and one day it will be the world.'" So, Elizabeth, how does it feel to know that you planted the seed for that in many of your efforts at Omega, to see it start to actually be the world, as he said it would one day be?
Well, you know, it's kind of overwhelmingly hard to really separate myself from the whole process and the place, because, as I said, I was just a kid when we started it. It was just a kind of wacky idea. We were young hippies trying. My ex-husband and I started Omega together, and he was a medical doctor, and I was an educator and a midwife, and we just had this idea. We're interested in these healing techniques and these spiritual techniques. Maybe other people will be. And in the beginning, it was such an so much of what we were offering through these workshops, and of course it started very small. We have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people come through now, but it was just a very small seed way back in the day. And back then it was very fringy. Now there's yoga studios in every corner and every town, and meditation is taught in hospitals and schools, and alternative medicine is covered by insurance, so it feels wonderful. I mean, I still, after all these years, believe deeply in the transformative power of a spiritual life and a healing life. So the fact that we've been able to help other people on their own journeys, deeply gratifying, and I'm very grateful that for some reason I had the idea to do such a thing.
Yeah. Looking back, would there have been anything you would have done differently?
You know, I don't live that way.
I
believe that we're guided, and we have karma, and we do things for all sorts of reasons we can't even fathom. So to say that would be to think that I had more power in my trajectory than I really do. So I deeply accept all the stupid mistakes I made and bow to the blessings that have come my way.
You also have a section in your book on heartfulness and the Seeker's Guide, but you quote Joseph Campbell at the beginning, who's one of my all-time favorite teachers, and a quote is this: "People say that what we're seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that's what we're seeking is an experience of being alive so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive." I think we all want to feel that rapture of being alive. So, Elizabeth, you have had a lot happen since you wrote that chapter. Do you think, after it all, that you've now gotten to that space of rapture in your own life?
I do, but I was just talking to a friend on the phone earlier today about how surprising that rapture tastes like at this stage in my life. It's kind of rapture at a bird at the bird feeder, and the color of fabric, and my little grandson's tiny infant fist, and a good meal. It seems I've traveled so far and done so many outlandish things to have discovered that rapture can be found in the simplest, treasured moments of life.
Elizabeth, can you share your web address so people can follow your work, learn more about you, and any upcoming books you might be having down the road?
Well, Omega's website is www.eomega.org, eomega.org, And I have a very active Facebook page, Elizabeth Lesser, and I post on it once a week. And, yeah, that's how you can find out about me.
I do recommend Elizabeth's book, Broken Open, How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow. We certainly are living in difficult times right now during this pandemic, COVID-19. We're living in very uncertain times. You know, we can respond in fear, and some people have, or we can choose to meet uncertainty with love. We can be less concerned about hoarding hand sanitizers and more concerned about sharing with others from our abundance. We can ask our senior citizens if they need us to go shopping for them. We can find out how you can help feed the precious children who are food challenged and will not receive a healthy lunch due to school closings. You can donate your time at a local food pantry. They certainly need more volunteers because a lot of people are going hungry right now. So in other words, during this time, we can serve instead of sulk. We can rise in love together because remember, this is one world and it is all sacred. In closing the interview with Elizabeth, I want to share a segment out of her book. It comes from one of the last chapters, and she writes this. Over and over, we are broken on the shore of life. Our stubborn egos are knocked around, and our frightened hearts are broken open. Not once, and not in predictable patterns, but in surprising ways and for as long as we live. The promise of being broken and the possibility of being opened are written into the contract of human life. Certainly, this tumultuous journey on the waves can be tiresome. When the sea is rough, and when we're suffering, we may want to give up hope and give in to despair. But brave pilgrims have gone before us. They tell us to venture forth with faith and vision. Rumi speaks for them all when he says, drums, sounds rise on the air, and with them my heart. A voice inside the beat says, I know you're tired, but come, this is the way. So may you listen to the voice within the beat, even when you're tired. When you feel yourself breaking down, may you break open instead. May every experience in life be a door that opens your heart, expand your understanding, and lead you to freedom. If you're weary, may you be aroused by passion and purpose. If you're blameful and bitter, may you be sweetened by hope and humor. If you're frightened, may you be emboldened by a big consciousness far wiser than you fear. And if you're lonely, may you find love. May you find friendship. And if you're lost, may you understand that we're all lost, and still we are guided by strange angels and sleeping giants, by our better and kinder natures, by the vibrant voice within the beat. May you follow that voice, for this is the way, the hero's journey, the life worth living, the reason we are here. And now here's a beautiful song from one of my favorite artists, Tina Malia. It's called Walking Home.
Faith will be a light. you find your way home to me? I pray for love to guide you on the road you walk upon. I pray for love to lift you up to the place where you belong. And I pray for you to know, as long as I am in this world, you will never walk alone. So climb any mountain, cross every sea, till you find your way home to me. Climb any mountain, cross every sea, till you find your way. See you now before me, light in the trees. Yes. See you now before me, and I believe. See you now before me, dancing like the light in the trees. See you now before.
I really believe Elizabeth Lesser walks in wisdom, and I have so enjoyed this book, Broken Open, How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow, and they surely can. And wasn't that a beautiful song from Tina Malia? It's off her Shores of Avalon. And I want to thank you for joining me today on 88.7 FM WICR. I want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I couldn't do this show without them. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time. Now, for the final part, we're going to play one more song off that beautiful album. It's called Shores of Avalon.
When we reach the shore.